yourself and this railroad in the bargain. Now, I want you to apologize to this. Yes, sir, can I help you? If they move, kill them.
Hello once again and welcome to Shooting the Ghost, The Secret Life of Movies. This is Jason Halsey. This week will be a continuation of conversations recorded and aired last week with Phil Snyder, Bill and John Morrison. Some of you are listening to this podcast may be a little bit curious about exactly why or how I've chosen to focus so exclusively on one particular filmmaker. Why Sam Peckinpah? What is it about Peckinpah that has so captured my attention that I'm now drawing all your attention to this one man and the themes that run through his life and his movies? Why? Why Sam? Well, of course, there's a very, very long answer to that question, and that is basically these podcasts. Hopefully together they will make up a very comprehensive answer to that question. And there's a very short answer, and there's a whole series of short answers. Maybe particularly curious to those of you listening who have somehow wound up here from following the podcasts that I made under the pseudonym, the alias of Aeolus Cephas, in which I discussed the end times, the arrival of intergalactic consciousness, grand global cosmic conspiracies, Kundalini rising, alien abductions, alchemy, and all the rest of it. Deep, deep subjects. So to bring it all down to a single man's psyche and a few movies might seem a little bit strange. But that's the way it goes. And Gurdjieff once said that, not that I'm a follower of Gurdjieff, but I did read this and I did find this somewhat interesting and somewhat true, that if we go deeply enough into any subject, we will find truth. We will begin to tune into the universe. We will discover God, the divine, the design of power. So, whether it's plumbing or carpentry, or philosophy or science, or quantum mechanics or movies, it really doesn't matter. We live in a holographic universe where the part contains the whole. So if we look deeply enough into any single part, then we're going to find the whole of creation therein, a blueprint. But the thing about Sam Peckinpah is that he was a lost soul, and I'm drawn to lost souls. I'm drawn to the cause of redemption for very personal reasons. The greatest line ever written in the history of theatre, of literature, of music, of art, of cinema, the greatest line ever written was not written by Shakespeare or Confucius or Lao Tse or St. Paul, Dostoevsky, or James Joyce, or Franz Kafka, or Milton, or Blake, or T.S. Eliot. My opinion, the greatest line ever written was written by Sam Peckinpah, and it was in a pulpy action western movie called The Wild Bunch.
Now that I find hard to believe.
Not so hard. Well, you'll dream of being a child again. Even the worst of us. perhaps the worst most of all.
You know what we are then?
So there you have it. A wound. Robert Bly says that all the old myths describe in their various ways how the source of our power and the source of self-knowledge is always found in the wound. It's only if those of us who are willing to go all the way into that wound, to experience the fullness of the agony and despair of that wound, who will ever enter into our power as men. That's the true heroic quest right there. Peckinpah's heroes are all men who failed to do that, and Peckinpah himself was a man who failed to do that, and yet it's not about success or failure in the end. Bly also talks about how the key to initiation is that it's enough for us to accept the challenge of initiation and to take the test of initiation, and whether we fail or succeed doesn't matter. So Peckinpah's life and his movies are about initiation, and though they're about failed initiation, they nonetheless have the power and meaning within them to lead us towards the truth of what it is that we must do as men. We must go into that wound and not flee from it, as Sam did and as his many characters did, at least until those final moments in which they were redeemed, in which they found grace through dying, through embracing their own annihilation, through allowing the wound to swallow them up. Of course, those were movies, and so they glorified and glamorized something that in real life would be sordid and base and anything but sublime or numinous. But that's the power of myths, is that they redeem something coarse and brutal, and they transform it into something sublime. And we can do that any minute, any hour, any second, any moment in our lives. We can turn things around, and we can draw forth the gold from the lead of our experience. We can surrender to our wounds and to our patterns and let them transform us. But to do that, we have to first of all cease trying to transform them or move out of them or move beyond them. So moving on, without further ado, this little languishing introduction, I'm going to begin then with a little segment, John and Bill. And this is about John's blessing, John and Bill's father, his wound, and how his wound came out in brutality, and how John's dog suffered as a result, which is to say, of course, John's primal nature.
It's what you weigh as you're engaged in your burst of living, and what comes out before editing, and the balance. How much can you be the rebel and have that ultimately reach over into the 51% at least, where you're successful with that attitude of rebellion that makes you what you are? Certainly, that's true of you or all of us as far as that goes. I mean, we are sort of successful.
Right. Yeah, you know, Bill, I got Bill's blessing too, especially when he got over the, now he'll probably, I don't know what he's going to say about this, but the, you know, I was always constantly reminded about the older brother, younger brother stuff, which I got very tired of through the years. The blessing did come later on. He was taught me a lot, of course. That's another thing.
And Dad had to fight off always his tendency to be brutal, which you never did see in his entire life. His father beat his mother, I think, was abusive. Maybe my dad got beat, I don't know, by my grandfather.
He did. Dad could be brutal, yeah, but not like that. I mean, you know,
Dad was not brutal. I mean,
he did throw my dog down the steps, down the stairs, down the basement stairs, threw him down. I didn't talk to my dad for, you know, several days after that, and he knew I was just furious at that.
And then there was, of course, my own father. The family business. the rebellion, the inevitable rebellion.
So, Jason, how about yourself?
It's a loaded subject, but I when I was about two, my mother was already having an affair with another man, and so my father was then having an affair with that man's wife. So it was almost like wife swapping. What do small children know? In a way, they know everything and nothing, don't they? At some level, of course, we know. And I was the last child, so by the time I came along, my father, was, who never wanted children anyway, was even less interested in me than he had been in the others, and the marriage was already, you know, certainly by the time I was two, if my mother was having an affair, then the marriage was already on the way out. So, but, I mean, I'm at a big disadvantage because I don't actually remember those first 7 years at all. I've got about four or five or six memories from the whole seven-year period. And the only one that relates to my father is of him being unconscious, drunk, on the bedroom floor in his underwear, face down. So that is, I mean, what Freud could, you know, have a field day with that, in terms of that's my recollection of my father. You know, it was just basically flat, horizontal, unconscious, drunk. I don't have any memories of him being fatherly with me. I don't have a single one. Because by the time he left us, that was about the time his legs started giving in. Certainly by the time I was an adolescent, he was walking on sticks. And so we visited him every Sunday, and he barely communicated, and he would sort of hide behind his newspaper as much as possible, because he was very awkward, unless he was drinking and had friends around and what have you. He was very awkward with his kids, so I can remember the occasional conversation. He was an atheist, so the strongest impression he made on me, like even pre-memory, but certainly that I can remember, was him always telling us that religion was a big scam, and not believing it was all just politics. And it was the same way about Christmas. So that was the one way that he was quite hands-on as a father. He took time to indoctrinate us with his atheism. His father, he hated his father. My grandfather was a Quaker, and became a Quaker. I don't think he was born into it. And he started a dairy business, very small, a little dairy. And he turned it into a decent little business. And then my father took over after he met my mother. And he was traveling around the US and Canada with a typewriter, trying to write the great British novel, which he, needless to say, he never finished or even started, I don't think. He met my mother in New Orleans. They met on a park bench. She approached him, and then they stayed up for 3 days and nights, and then he proposed to her. They got married.
Oh boy!
And they went back to England.
Oh. That's
and then, of course, he joined the family business, because at that point he had a wife to support, and so at that point I guess he decided that he needed to be pragmatic about it. And although he hadn't wanted to join the family business, he did. And under his rule, his guidance, it became a multinational corporation that was providing McDonald's with 50% of its meat at one point. A huge business. But he was a very unusual man in that regard, because you can even read about him on the internet, that he was actually a socialist, and he ran his business in a very, I'm not sure what the word here is, but in that he was a very considerate, a socialist kind of boss, in equal rights, and he wasn't a cutthroat businessman, is what I'm trying to say. And yet somehow he managed to turn the business into this huge success without actually resorting to the usual cutthroat tactics that businessmen are notorious for employing. So he was quite an example in a way, in that particular way. Even though he never wanted to be a businessman, he always wanted to be a writer.
Well, you certainly have rebelled against some natural inclinations.
The boys want to be with the boys, the girls want to be with the girls. What is it? What is it? What is it? Where does the fear of bonding come from? What is it that we are really afraid of as men, being among men? Why is that so terrifying to us and yet so enticing? The greatest desire is also our greatest fear. That's always the way it goes. We live in a culture in which sexual obsession, infatuation with the female, and adoration of her beauty has almost entirely supplanted the natural instinctive desire to be with men and to admire male grace and beauty, which is something we can actually emulate without striving to possess it. The woman does not need to be admired or adored or worshipped. She needs to be taken and contained. But to have a man to look up to, on the other hand, is absolutely vital and essential for the development of the male psyche and for coming of age and coming into manhood. And how many of us can say that we ever had that, experienced that in our lives? We are all mama's boys, whether we know it or care to admit it or not. Well, the boys want to be with the boys, the girls want to be with the girls. You know, there's that Talking Heads song, Boys Want to Be with the Boys. Actually, it's called Girls Want to Be with the Girls, I think, but it's both, you know, how the sexes like to stay together.
Yeah.
And of course, we see this all the time, and, you know, I certainly know what it's like. If I'm just with a group of guys, then it's relatively relaxed and easygoing, and then as soon as the female enters in, there's that sort of extra tension and self-consciousness. But what I said to Michelle was that guys basically, they feel more comfortable being with guys up to a certain point. And then when it reaches that point, then they start to feel uncomfortable, and then they actually they want the women to be present. And I think that, and it's not something I'd ever thought before, but I think there's something in this, and okay, maybe it's quite rare to actually get to that point with guys, but I've definitely experienced it. And I think it's this, is when if guys get close enough, then something starts to happen, some sort of bonding starts to occur, and that's very frightening. It's very kind of exposing. And so then if you can bring a woman into that, or go down to the whorehouse or whatever it is, then that potential is lost, you know, and then you can start being guys again and, you know, fucking whores and get back into that sort of quasi macho thing that is basically under threat if you get too close, if male psyches get too close. And I think, you know, there's a basically obvious thing, is this fear of homosexuality or fear of being perceived as homosexual, which is a relatively recent thing. Let's face it, you know, the whole homosexuality has become acceptable, and that's made it in a way more threatening, I think, rather than less threatening to straight people,
right?
Because there's always that sense of, you know, people might misunderstand, you know, and so male bonding would be so similar to, in a way, you know, to homosexuality, because it's men getting close together, you know, except that it's psychological and emotional rather than just physical. It could be physical as well, because it could be fight club kind of wrestling or what have you, but there's nothing faggy about it, obviously, because it's actually kind of reinforcing your maleness potentially.
Yeah,
but it now has these associations with fagginess, which is again I think why, you know, so again with the Wild Bunch, they have this, they get so close and then they go to the whorehouse, and that's the only thing they really do together besides kill and drink, isn't it, is go to the whorehouse. That's basically it.
Yeah.
And with Peckinpah, probably the same. They either drank together, they made movies together, or they went to the whorehouse together, you know.
Yeah, there is that dynamic. Now for me, when I get concerned about a group or begin to become self-conscious and want to get out of a group, it's mainly, at least I think it is, consciously it feels like I just don't like to do things in unison with other people, and I don't like to feel like now we're a group. Okay, now we're a group, you know. I need to return to myself, you know. It's not avoidance so much of, you know, some fear of some homophobia or whatever you might call it. It's not really homophobia, because it's a more latent sort of fear of bonding sort of thing. I'd have to think more about that, and even then I might not be able to truly express it.
Again, I know what you're talking about, and I experience it too, but my guess is that it's to do with, if you get too close to integrating into a group, then it potentially exposes the areas of resistance or blockage or wounding that relate to our, probably yeah. relate to our relationships with our mothers, particularly, you know, whatever it is that yeah. makes us unable to bond with men is to do yeah. with how we've been bonded to our mothers and emasculated in some deep yeah. way. And of course, you know, in the most superficial way, that comes out in the coarse male bonding mm-hmm. rituals of sport or whore fucking or you know, pissing yeah. competitions or circle jerks or yeah. stuff I never did for that very reason, is that I wouldn't be able to handle that kind of intimacy on the one hand, but also the sense of inadequacy that inevitably yeah. comes up if one's maleness is just a question of, you know, yeah. a brute stamina or...
Yeah, I mean, there's competition. There's a danger associated because, okay, now we're in competition. And that aspect comes out. For me, it's also probably something, a little bit of a avoidance of obligation. You know, okay, now that we're doing this in unison, I'm part of the group. And now that I'm part of the group, we have to meet again tomorrow. I'm sorry, I can't... You know, suddenly I'm canceling and then I quit. Right. I mean, I was a Cub Scout for about 3 or 4 weeks, and I just couldn't, you know, once I was given schedules and expected to have a meeting here and go over here and do this and do that, it's like, no, I can't, you know, I quit. I would have quit school when I was 6 years old if I could have, too, you know. I would have quit my job today rather than just walking out, you know. It's an obligation sort of thing, just want to be left alone and do as I please, whenever I please. Very selfish, maybe egotistical, but I don't know what else that would be, you know.
Well, what about stage fright?
There's that aspect. It's an aspect.
You ever suffer from a kind of stage fright or performance anxiety in a group?
Not really. I usually, you know, hesitation up to the point, but then when it gets to the point, I usually jump out front. Like, say, if we have a meeting at work or whatever it is, I'm pretty much known for being quiet until towards the end, and then they give me a little opening, right, and I'll jump up and I'll take over.
But, I mean, that just means you're an extrovert. That doesn't... I mean, that's right. A separate thing, I think, because I'm that too. But I definitely get stage fright, not necessarily on stage, but I mean, what you're describing, for example, of that non-stickability. I mean, I think it's slightly disingenuous to make out that it's just to do with you not wanting to commit, or you can't be bothered, or you just want to be on your own. Because a lot of the times when you've bailed out on what we've been doing, it's been for deeper reasons, hasn't it? It's actually been because we've been getting close to something and it's been threatening, and so you've just said, fuck this, you know?
Well, that's part of it. That's part of it. There's more to it, of course, but I'll have to think about it and kind of like expand upon it before I don't want to like only say part of it and, you know, or miss the point or whatever it is. But yeah, you mentioned stage fright. I was thinking about that, and it's like, yeah, okay. Now that I'm part of the group, I'm expected to be here and you're doing something, but it's a different sort of context. It's like everything now becomes a performance, and people are looking at you and judging how you're doing. If it's spontaneous and they're not expecting a performance, I can give one. Right. But now that it's a regular thing, and now I'm expected to put out and come up with something each time, you know, it's, again, you know, like my silent periods. It's like, okay, now I just can't do it. There's a stage fright sort of thing, because there's expectation now.
You're talking about the context and the conversation.
It's being judged. Well, yeah, emails or you know, anything where I pull away from a group in which I feel I'm now becoming part of.
Right, so yeah, I mean, that's...
Because, you know, now I'm going to be judged.
Which isn't actually the case, is it? Again, that's
a
way of avoiding an even deeper fear, which is, now I'm going to be integrated.
Yeah, that could be. Also, family, I never really... I would like to know what someone who... And I don't think Bill and John completely qualify, because... As relatively normal as their family sounds and seems to have been and be, it's not quite the norm, obviously. But I would like to know whether it really exists or not. I don't know. I think it really does. There's a lot of stereotypically, ridiculously normal, relatively happy families out there. How they would respond to any of this. Because I never really had that. Not that it was a bad family, but... I don't want to lay, there's no guilt on anybody else. It's just we couldn't get anything. We can't do anything together. We cannot do anything together. Never could. We did a, I know we're like past time, but I assume some of the beginning parts we'll have to cut out. My brother Tom, who he got his PhD in film from Northwestern back in the mid-80s. And my dad had cooked up the idea that he wanted the whole family to go out there and attend the graduation. So he rented a Winnebago, and he was going to do this big old family outing. We were going to go for 3 days up to Chicago, the Chicago area, and watch Tom graduate. Now, I knew this was a bad idea from the start. The original idea was to just rent a car and have me drive him, my mom, and my little brother Matt. But then he decided it's going to be a Winnebago, and it's going to be everybody, you know, all the brothers and sisters and their spouses and kids. And I knew it was a bad idea from the start. I made arrangements to sleep at my brother's house and not stay in the Winnebago. And it just really degraded pretty fast. Dad was smoking reefer the whole time and drinking Bud. And, you know, my mom was drinking beer, and she was drunk and getting mean and angry at him and just sitting there staring at him. And he was just clowning around and acting like an idiot the whole way. And, you know, you could tell that something was about ready to pop. One of my brother-in-laws, he was behind the wheel, and, you know, he had the little vial of cocaine, and he was snorting cocaine and had a little Jim Beam, and he's hitting the Jim Beam, and he's the driver, you know. And, of course, they won't let me drive because apparently I don't know how to drive, you know, but, you know, I was probably definitely the best driver in the car, I can tell you that much. You know, it's just kids running around screaming, just fucking insane. Of course, I go off once we hit Chicago. We have, like, dinner and then, you know, or lunch, I guess it was. Stayed at my brother's house, and then the next morning we get a phone call. Apparently, things got a little wild the night before. My brother-in-law, who was the driver, he really didn't want to go on the trip the whole time because his brother was in town back here in Dayton, and he wanted to stay here and visit with his brother, his family. But my dad, being the forceful guy he is, made him go along and drive the Winnebago. And, you know, he'd already been hyped up on the Jim Beam, probably drank the whole fifth and then some, and the little vial of cocaine, probably refilled it a couple more times, and Mom was drunk, and everybody was drunk, and you know, except for the kids, I guess. And he flipped out, and he just got out of escaped from the Winnebago, and was walking down the highway. And my sister went to go get him, and then the cops saw him struggling together on the highway, and they stopped him, and they didn't realize he is full of cocaine and Jim Beam. They thought he was crazy. And, of course, nobody's going to say, oh, he's just all coked up. This guy's who's going to go to fucking jail, you know? So they carted his ass off and had a psychiatrist evaluate him back at the police station. And apparently they decided he needed to be sent away for a week's worth of evaluation in Elgin, Illinois, at the insane asylum there, which was about 2-3 hours away, counting the traffic that you'd have to go through. So this is all the night before. It's like we just hit town, and I left, and then we get up in the morning, and then my brother Tom, he's getting a phone, like half asleep. And, oh no, what? He did, who? Where is he? Oh shit, what the hell happened? And they said, Roy's in an insane asylum in Elgin, Illinois. We gotta go pick up his girlfriend and get him out, you know. Luckily, my brother Tom's girlfriend was a psychology student. But she knew the language, and she was getting her PhD in that. She was gonna be a psychoanalyst, whatever. Family therapist, I don't know what the hell she was going to be. So she knew all the lingo, so we did a little field trip, and we rented a car. No, we took my brother's car, got on a highway, myself, my sister, who was married to my brother-in-law, and my brother Tom's current girlfriend at the time, and went off to Elgin, Illinois to talk to him there and get him out of the insane asylum. And she was lucky enough to say just the right things, and they got him out. But, you know, it was... And there were other things that happened at the same time, too. But that's the kind of family outing, family get-together. Hey, let's all do this one thing together kind of, you know, experience. And that's exactly how it always played out. It was always like that. So, of course, I'm not going to, you know, I don't have the basic model of following along and being part of a group and being assimilated into it.
You know? Yeah, good point.
That's the group I want to be part of course. So, you know. Whether that provides any background or insight, I don't know. But
well, it's a good story, anyway. Yeah. I think it's in our genes, you know, to tell stories.
Yeah.
It's just an old tradition.
Moving on, then. Part 3. Robert Bly, the need for mentors, the slaying of the king, and how Bill never got his father's blessing.
But you know, this Bly thing, this idea he had, an older man to look up to, a mentor to teach, to be with, usually it isn't your father, apparently. It was a point that he was actually making, and that would be apparently evidentially true. But I've always looked at what should happen is for the father to turn over his sword. And that ritual of medieval times always made an impression on me. You know, now it's your turn, son. I give you my blessing. Here's my sword on your shoulder. Yes, my liege, my sire. And I'm beholding to you. Thank you. Now I can do my job, do my mission. I always thought that I missed that for my father. There was no formality, but there was no business to turn over to us, to me. That was down the tubes, and then on he worked for somebody else. It also would take away a little bit of the need to kill your father for your the Oedipal thing or whatever, to take over the business, mostly.
Well, that was often a way that the son did claim his power, wasn't it, by slaying the father symbolically or otherwise, because that's closer. I can relate to that more easily. I mean, just because of my own personal history, there was nothing. Part 4, returning to the Wild Bunch, finally Peckinpah's Opus Magnus, one of the greatest and most enduring movies of all time. Yet also one of the most simple and brutal. Why is that? What does it say about our culture and our world that one of the movies that most fully encapsulates and represents our time was a movie such as The Wild Bunch? The metatext of male bonding and of regeneration through violence. And how men are unified and brought together by a common refusal to bond or to be part of a group that consists of people who are not willing to belong to any group. It's even the paradoxical nature of the title, The Wild Bunch. The wildness implies freedom, individuality, maverick, unruly spirit, as the bunch is the unification of different elements whose wildness actually brings them together and allows them to integrate, finally, but only in the wild and primal act of death. Can death be an act? Can death be something that doesn't simply happen to us? Yep, if you want to go out in the blaze of glory, it can.
So what about the kind of mythologized and fictionalized version of it in The Wild Bunch, say, or even in what we know of Peckinpah's life with his dog brothers, with Coburn and L.Q. Jones and Lee Marvin, and that whole, you know, drinking, whore-fucking, fighting, brawling, macho kind of thing. Does that have any appeal to you, like, in a real sense, or is it just kind of vicarious?
Oh, in a real sense? All the people that I've known that have been similar to that have been assholes who I could not stand. Mm-hmm. A lot of the men that you just mentioned, I admire, and I think they probably would be cool. I would like them. Maybe I would like to be part of that. Perhaps. Maybe the group you just mentioned is a group of men who would have all refused to run in circles around the giant invisible 50-foot-tall robot. Mm. And then eventually they found each other and then formed a group of their own that was based upon this refusal to play along in a false situation that, is just totally unlivable, that you cannot accept. Mm. Because, you know, think of the Wild Bunch themselves in a fictional example. I mean, they're all criminals, so obviously none of them played along. None of them were part of a group. They all were outside of the town folk. You know, think of the town folk as those people who accept the inauthentic bonding rituals and so on. And the Wild Bunch, of course, would have rejected it, but then they've also founded their own bunch or group, a sub-society, a subculture, a misfit culture. So yeah, that finding something like that would be appealing. But again, my experiences of the realities of it is that I really don't know enough people like that to actually form anything like that. And I would assume that if I met the types in real life that I would possibly encounter, I would not like them or want to be part of that group.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's sort of a it's a admiration and wishing you could be part of it, but realizing it's also an archetypal and an ideal and something far off. These are celebrities on the other side of the country, you know, and there's really no way for me to be part of that.
Mm.
Though obviously I've admired and respected and somehow wanted to be part of that, you know, through the whole Lee Marvin thing and everything else that we've discussed over the years. Clearly it's something that we would desire in some sense, but is
right.
It really possible in reality?
Well,
my experience says no.
I mean, it's clearly there's something in our psyches, which is archetypal, which senses, which knows at a visceral level instinctively that this is something we need or desire, and then it's going to project that, just as Peckinpah did in making the Wild Bunch. He projected his own kind of archetypal longing onto this group of killers and thugs, and he knew, and anybody who sees the film knows, that that is not what it was like, and that's not what it would ever be like if you were actually hanging out with a bunch of bandits and killers. You know, it would be a very different thing, and so presumably the same is true of his own group, which presumably didn't consider itself a group at all. You know, they just happened to hang out together. Of these guys, the actors and Peckinpah and his confederates, that, you know, we get certain pieces filtered down to us through the media, through the stories and the legends and the anecdotes, and we put those pieces together and we create again this archetypal picture of Sam and Lee and Coburn and LQ Jones and the Dog Brothers, and we fill in the gaps and we turn it into something, you know, romantic, in order to meet some deep desire in our psyche. But again, it wouldn't have been like that, would it? I bet if we were hanging out, if we could, you know, somehow transport ourselves to that time and hang out with a drunken bunch of actors and Sam and what have you, we'd probably find that most of the time it wasn't really that much fun at all. It was probably just a bunch of guys getting fucked up, you know, just like any other bunch of guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably. I mean, it would be a little different, of course, than just average people doing such a thing, because,
sure.
Well, most people are pretty stupid and not interesting, and they're boring, and they would really only have the drink or drugs or whatever. They would not. And from witnessing my father and all his cronies, I mean, he had a lot of cronies. If you think of a movie like in Blue Velvet, there's Frank Booth, and he has the people that he runs around with, the groups of guys that my dad ran around, they're all like that. You know that scene where they're at Ben's, and Jack Nance comes up to Jeffrey, what was his name, Kyle MacLachlan, and claps his hand and says, "I'm Paul." When I was growing up, it's like there's always some guy like that. "I'm Paul" to me, you know. There's Carl Kaiser, this big drugged out pill-headed Indian guy. I think he was like 100% Cherokee, maybe. Real tall, 6'4". He had this like greased back, sort of Elvis-looking DA, and he was obviously an Indian guy. Popped a lot of pills, and you know, you couldn't understand a word he said. He'd say "zab zab 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 zab," you know, and that would be basically is your dad home. He'd say, "Carl, Kaiser's on the phone," you know, and the Kaiser would come over and, you know, it's just endless freak show, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, my imagination, my anticipation of it was that if I found a group of guys like that, they'd all be like my dad's cronies, and I sure as shit wouldn't want to hang around with them, you know?
Right. Hmm.
And, you know, I could give you 100 more examples, you know? And each one of them fit for a character role in a film, but not anybody you'd really want to know, you know?
Right.
I love them in Blue Velvet. And I love Paul. I love those guys.
Mm-hmm.
I love the Wild Bunch, you know? I love those actors. I love Coburn. I love Marvin. I love LQ Jones. All those guys, you know? And, you know, I'm sure that they probably manage to get something good going once in a while, but, you know, for the most part, like you say, they're probably just getting fucked up, you know?
Well, I think, I mean, another difference would be with those guys is that, like the Wild Bunch, they would actually have some sort of mission some of the time. So if they were hanging out together on the set of a movie and getting fucked up afterwards, then it would... it would have a certain integrity to it. I mean, they would be bonding not just over the alcohol, the whores, or the, you know, the brawling, but they would actually be bonding over some creative endeavor, which would be like with the Wild Bunch. Okay, it's not exactly creative, but there's an intent behind it. They are actually fusing their wills together in order to accomplish something, whether it's something very base like, you know, robbing a train, or something more kind of sophisticated or lofty, like making a work of art. But nonetheless, I mean, that must be a key factor now, that men coming together, like you say, I mean, men coming together to bond is just, you know, the skin kind of crawls at the idea of it. But that's presumably because men didn't ever come together in order to bond. They came together for some other purpose, and then the bonding just took care of itself. It would have been a side effect, but at the same time, it would have been integral for them, like to go on the hunt, for example. Men going on the hunt together, they have to be coordinated. They have to be in tune. Or men going into battle is a better example, perhaps. They've got to really be connected at a very deep level and have this deep kind of trust between them. That would, of course, increase and develop the more often they did go on the hunt or go into battle, and it would be this very deep emotional, psychic bond between them that would develop, and that would presumably have some purpose even beyond that of the ostensible missions, you know, that maybe wouldn't even be spoken about, which would be to do with this collective tribal consciousness of male psyches actually fusing into a whole, which, you know, is something that we simply don't experience, and the Wild Bunch didn't experience. They had to, the only way they could fuse was by going into on a suicide mission together, you know. And that, I think that's kind of where I'm curious about taking this, is like, what, you know, if that's the closest we have to sort of representation of the archetypal male bonding writer, at least that's the one that's pertinent to our conversation now, is Sam Peckinpah's Wild Bunch. And so here are these guys who are, you know, they're macho guys, they're brutal guys, they're not into touchy-feely stuff, and they're not going to talk about deep stuff, and they're not, you know, all that. They're only together because basically they want to make one last score, and, you know, and yet there's something moving in them, in their psyches, in their souls, which is drawing them towards this realization of their, I don't know what you want to call it, their oneness, their affinity, which is so deep. And women just aren't part of that. That's the thing in the Wild Bunch. It's just women don't belong in that process. But they don't know what it is either, you know, because they kill together, they drink together, and they fuck whores together. But what do they actually do together? They're not going to fuck each other. It's not a fag thing. And yet it needs to be that intimate and that kind of exposing, you know, that all revealing somehow, like just no barriers between them. And so then that is enacted in their death march, and they're unified to rescue Angel because he's one of the group, and they're, you know, the group will destroy itself rather than lose its integrity, I guess. And then that self-destruction together is the ultimate integration, finally.
Okay. No, I would definitely, yeah. No, I think that's pretty much it there. I mean, there would have to be, to go back towards the beginning of what you just said, there has to be another context or focus for the bonding other than the bonding itself, because that misses the point. That's not real bonding if it's just the bonding itself is the focus. There needs to be a context. There needs to be some other medium through which you do it. Then to go forward, as you said, it's like they would rather die than have the group lose its integration. So of course they have to go rescue Angel because he's part of the bunch, and that is the ultimate expression of the bonding that they had bonded. The fact that they are all basically going to their deaths, to rescue Angel, to once again be whole. Mm. Because they're not whole without him, because he was with them through everything else they did.
Right, and Angel also, and he represented the purest aspect of the group, didn't he? Because he was the only one
right.
in the group
hence
who
Angel.
Actually, hence the name.
I don't know why the hell I didn't let them kill you.
Listen, I'm not going to steal guns for that devil to rob and kill my people again.
Noble, noble, very noble. I didn't see no tears rolling down your cheek when you rode in from Starbuck.
They were not my people. I care about my people, my village, Mexico.
Listen, boy, you ride with us, your village don't count. If it does, you just don't go along.
Then I don't go along.
Angel, one load of guns ain't gonna stop them raiding villages.
Don't you see, this is their land, and no one is gonna drive them away. Would you give guns to someone to kill your father, or your mother, or your brother?
10,000 cuts an awful lot of family ties.
He was also Mexican, and they were in Mexico, and that was Sam's kind of promised land, if you will. So he had that purity, and Angel's Village was where the bunch rediscovered their purity for a moment, that childlike nature. So all these themes running together. But what I was going to me as you were speaking, that I'd never thought about in watching The Wild Bunch, is that if Angel represents that transpersonal or selfless aspect of the group, because he was just giving his money to the cause of his village, then he would be the part of the group that they most had to protect, you know. And but also that by protecting it and by sacrificing themselves to save it, even though they couldn't, of course, they were actually transcending. They were going to the next level. They were no longer a bunch of bandits. They were actually dying for a cause, finally.
Right. Yeah, what was the name of Bo Hopkins, Kiss My Sister's Black Cat's Ass? What was his character's name at the beginning?
Damn you. You're going to put me to the test now. Crazy,
I can't remember.
Crazy
well,
Lee.
Anyways,
it's
him.
Crazy Lee,
yeah.
Hey, stop! Stop! Fellas flew like a turkey. Well, they shouldn't have run. They shouldn't have run. Well, how'd you like to kiss my sister's black cat's ass?
Well, they had to leave Crazy Lee behind, and then there's the scene where I can't remember. I keep wanting to call him Walter Houston, but the older guy. He asked Pike how Lee did, and he said he did okay. And then he learns that it's like his nephew or his grandson or whatever it is. Hmm. And the old timer, he just wants to know that the kid pulled his own weight, that he came through, that he did the right thing, and he didn't care whether he lived or died ultimately. And but you could tell that Pike, he didn't realize it. It was a little bit of a shock to him that he might have went back and you know, made sure that he didn't get left behind.
Hmm.
If he had known that his old friend, that he was, you know, his nephew or whoever, I think it was his nephew, I think he says it was his sister's kid. That regret is kind of carried through to the end, where it's like, okay, we're not going to do it this time. And then another thing that just popped in my head was that there's always that line that you hear in conjunction with the military, never leave a man behind, sort of thing.
Right, and it's what Pike says when he says, mm-hmm. when you side with a man, you stick with him, otherwise you're no better than some animal.
Pike, you know,
know a damn thing, except I either lead this bunch or end it right now. We're going to stick together just like it used to be. When you side with a man, you stay with him, and if you can't do that, you're like some animal. You're finished. We're finished. All of us.
Because he doesn't live by that code, although he dies by it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these are all themes that were the right there on the surface of Wild Bunch, and we've been aware of them, but not in this particular context.
Yeah.
I've never thought of the Wild Bunch until today as a kind of archetypal blueprint for male bonding. Yeah, even though it very obviously is
that.
But yeah, I mean, these are all these key themes in the movie that we're talking about now are actually tie into that exactly in what we're talking about, how the group is failing to integrate throughout, and how we're seeing that, and then how only through Angel's capture, to the loss, to the awareness of that, of having to protect that the pure
the purest aspect of the group, which is the psyche, you know, then the whole thing comes into integration, but it's destroyed by it, which presumably is because it realized too late, I guess you could say. Because what the hell else would the bunch do, you know? How? That's the thing that Peckinpah's films are all about, is men out of time.
We gotta start thinking beyond our guns. Those days are closing fast.
The old male bonding rituals, which, as we've said, were not about bonding, but they were bonding, were all around hunting and war, and also shamanic, you know, initiations, particularly that would perhaps be the oldest form of bonding, and that's all gone now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so all we're left with is this macho kind of distorted equivalent of it, which is why when we're getting at, you know, the most common likely kind of male bonding seems to occur in the coarsest, most profane way among the sort of stupidest, most unappealing kind of guys, with the sport, with the drinking, with the whoring, the kind of thing that you or I would rather die than be part of. Moving on, part 5. Disinheriting the fortune, rejecting the legacy. The nature of the business, blood money, and the bad king. Well, that would be the way that you slay the father. I mean, in my case, for example, I didn't realize this until years later, ironically, but when I gave away my inheritance, of course that came from the father. That was the only thing that he gave us, really. I mean, when I was 24, I essentially threw it away. I disinherited that fortune in order to go on my own quest for meaning. And so, yeah, looking back on that later, I realized that when he heard about that, that must have been quite a blow to him. But it wasn't intended as that.
Need your fucking money, Dad.
It was more than not needing it. It was actually being oppressed by it, being trapped by it. It also came from a business that was, if not founded on, it was definitely supported by an enormous amount of slaughter. I mean, these slaughterhouses, which I was a vegetarian for years, because when I found out the nature of the slaughterhouses, I couldn't eat meat. And, but that had nothing to do with my getting rid of the money either, but it was literally blood money that I was getting rid of. Some deep part of me was rejecting not just my father, but a whole way of life that he ended up embodying and representing to me, you know, like the bad king, you know. Not that he was a bad man, but he'd become integral to a system which is corrupt, you know, and that I knew that I couldn't possibly follow in his footsteps. Ironically, of course, he was crippled, so he didn't leave any footsteps at all. Returning to the Wild Bunch, death is destiny, and how a bunch of rebels and killers finally found something to live for when they found a cause to die for.
There's that line when they're, I think they're at the village, Borgnine and Holden, and Pike says that he wants to just make one last big score and back off, and Borgnine says, back off to what?
Mm-hmm.
This was going to be my last. Ain't getting around any better. I'd like to make one good score and back off. Back off to what?
Meaning, of course, there is nothing else to back off to. They have nothing. There's no retirement. There really is. All they really had all along was death and whatever amount of drinking, whoring, and fucking and carousing that they needed while they were alive. And then when that ends, it's death. There's no other life outside of that, because what else do they have? That and each other. So, basically, that's their retirement plan. They had no future. This is like their destiny almost at the end. It's sort of in one sense, it sort of pays for the massacre that they initiated at the beginning. They didn't want to kill all the people in the town or you know, really hurt anybody. They just wanted the fucking money, you know? But because of their attempt to rob it, they set in motion events and their previous life of crime, they set in motion events that led to the slaughter in the town. So the slaughter at the end sort of pays for the slaughter at the beginning, which was sort of a bad, unintentional sort of slaughter. And another thing that kind of popped in my head, whether it's viable or not, is the fact that, of course, they sacrifice their lives to rescue Angel, which is not a rescue. He's dead already. I mean, even if Mapache had cut his throat, I don't think he would have survived. No. But he did cut his throat, and then that set the ball in motion, basically.
A los gringos otra vez.
What do you want?
Yeah. We want Angel.
You want Angel, no? All right. I am going to give it to you.
But in their slaughter of Mapache and then his men, basically, his entire force that he had with him, there might be a few stragglers left, but they're all useless at this point. Mm-hmm. They're just going to go back to the village. They're not going to be good for any more fighting.
Right.
Basically, they've helped out the cause of the revolution. And the they helped his cause. So they did it to, in a way, they not only served their own cause, which is... they went out in a blaze of glory,
right?
But they helped right. Angel. So they helped the only person, the only member of the bunch who had any goal outside of just the next whore or the next bag of gold. They helped him, the one guy who had at least a mission in life. They gave him his little present to Angel at the end.
Right.
It's almost noble in a way. There's no nobility to it, but you know they're dead, and that doesn't matter. They've helped out the fighters in the mountains. You know.
Yeah, well, I think this is kind of unconscious nobility. I mean, I think because that pure primal aspect of them that made them warriors in the end made them heroes because they unconsciously aligned with the forces of freedom or however you want to describe that. They were simply going out in a blaze of glory and trying to live by their own code, but then unconsciously they were, as you pointed out, were actually aligning themselves with a positive force that maybe, and that was their wistfulness in Angel's Village, was that feeling that they'd lost something that they could never regain, which would be that, we'd be having a cause, a cause to live for, which they only found by having a cause to die for.
Here's your dose and one to grow on, and that's all you're going to get out of me.
Dos es más que dos. Por eso 12 por cada uno.
Démenlo, démenlo. No me dieron nada, pero ojalá. No hice bien. Me lleve el diablo de su mujer. Si yo les cumplí, ¿por qué no me lo dieron?
Let's go. Why not?
Again, that's running through Sam's films, you know, like a bloody wound through all his work. Is these men who are adrift in a world like where they've got no frame of reference, and only by dying, basically through violence, do they find some sort of sense of themselves, and then finally by dying, do they potentially find some sort of grace?
Yeah. That's definitely would be one of the major unifying themes in all of his work, I suppose.
You want to come along? It ain't like it used to be, but it'll do.
All day long.